gathering. Yeah, when I made up the title, I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about. I thought it might have something to do with that column that I'll tell you about in a moment. Is this on? It's not? It is. You can hear me. You can hear me way back there? Good. But then when I noticed that I was opening the program, I thought, well, what better way to open the program than to extrapolate this into an entirely different and even more outrageous realm, because that will make everybody who follows totally free to state their innermost thoughts, conjectures, hopes, and fears, provided you're sufficiently gentle, of course, with the speaker. So anyway, here we go. There's a subtitle. Do the measurement problem and the problem of transience both arise from the same bad habit? And this has to do with this Physics Today column, which I'm beginning a talk with the references. You can download it at physicstoday.org, and you don't have to pay them any money to get it. And in that column, I try to make the point that one should view certain notions that are dear to one as a physicist with a certain amount of suspicion. And I talk about a certain bad habit. I give a definition of bad habit. Bad habit is something you do without being fully aware of it that makes life harder than it needs to be. And then I say that it's a bad habit of physicists to take their most successful abstractions to be real properties of the world. And what I thought I was saying was one should just be on the lookout for this. I took as my motto a wonderful quotation I found at an art show at the Met in New York about a year ago by Giorgio Morandi, who paints nothing but jars. And nevertheless said there is nothing more abstract than reality. And the name of this bad habit is reification. And the first thing I discovered when I submitted this column to Physics Today was that nobody at Physics Today had ever come across the word reification, which kind of surprised me. I mean, in the quantum foundations community, surely one talks about reifying this and reifying that. I then gave a 15-minute little talk in Copenhagen on the contents of this forthcoming column, which came out in May. I gave the talk in March, and discovered that although everybody at the Bohr Institute speaks perfect English, nobody had ever heard the word reification. Then I got a letter from Sir Dennis Wilkinson saying, I didn't know that word was used in the United States. I sent him a nice reply, which bounced. This was a paper letter, and I learned how you reply to paper letters with other paper letters, and made the attempt, and it was returned, saying no such person, which suggests that he has his own reification problems. Anyway, here's a definition of reification from Wikipedia, which I think is amazingly good. Reification occurs when specifically human creations are misconceived as facts of nature, results of cosmic laws, or manifestations of divine will. I think the last misconception is not a problem among most physicists, but facts of nature and cosmic laws are something one should watch out for. Then in the very latest issue of Physics Today, which may not yet have arrived in your mailbox, which you can also download online without paying anything from physicstoday.org, there are a dozen letters, as Rob mentioned, which reacted to various things in the column. Makes quantum mechanics sound too weird. Doesn't make quantum mechanics sound weird enough. Those two letters were from two people at the same institution who I know don't get along with each other. Real is not defined, and you can object today that real will not be defined. Defiantly will not be defined, because I really don't know how. But I can give some examples. Then there were the rhetorical questions. Do I believe that the Earth moves around the sun? Are atoms real? The article undermines the quest for objective truth about the universe. It's more conducive to peace of mind than the scientific inquiry. And the final complaint, which actually came from this very institute, what I had written was a polemic and not very insightful dismissal of quantum foundations in the philosophy of science, which is precisely the thing to open a conference on quantum foundations. So, an example of the kind of issue I'm thinking about and that I hope we will be talking about a lot in the course of the week, are quantum states real? And here's a view that I think a lot of physicists have. You might call them sort of lumpen physicists on the reality of the quantum state. In two-slit electron diffraction, there's something real that goes through both slits. I think Phil Pearl can correct me. I think John Bell called this stuff, wave function stuff. And the stuff propagates out from the source. It spreads enough to cover both slits. It interferes with itself on the far side like an ordinary wave. And then it condenses into a single spot on the screen. I have a feeling that this attitude toward the quantum state is particularly common among solid-state physicists, which is what I used to be before I started saying crazy things. And I think part of the reason for that is that the last part and then condenses itself into a single spot and the screen really never comes up. I mean, you just take mean values at the end, and the things you're calculating are things like electrical currents and thermal currents. And it's irresistible to think of real waves propagating in these crystals. I think one of the reasons is that the analogy with classical X-rays is so strong. I mean, classical X-rays have Bragg peaks at which they they don't enter the crystal, and quantum waves have energy gaps at which they don't propagate in the crystal. It's the same thing. And it's almost irresistible to think of it that way, that there's this way. And also because one tends to neglect interactions, so one can form nice one-electron pictures where your configuration space is ordinary three-dimensional space. So you goodness, sorry about that. You think of this stuff as propagating, this electron stuff as propagating in a wave-like way in the crystal. So that's quantum states being real. On the other hand, I don't think many people would say that works for alpha decay. That is, you'd have to say that during alpha decay, wave function stuff slowly oozes out of the nucleus. until the growing cloud of stuff abruptly gives birth to a helium nucleus, whereupon the cloud vanishes, the leakage stops, and the nucleus loses 4 mass units. I think there are very few physicists who would say that's what's going on in alpha decay. One tends to look at that in terms of Poisson distributions and probabilities per unit time and so forth and so on. Anyway, those are sort of the two poles of reification. Now, what I want to suggest is a sort of classical situation, which is very much like the measurement problem. And so let me very quickly formulate the measurement problem, which is, does quantum mechanics conflict with the fact that things actually do happen? So that a vertically polarized photon goes into a birefringent crystal, oriented so that the photon's equally likely to be found in in one of two beams, the ordinary beam, the extraordinary beam. There are counters in each beam, and one or the other counter actually clicks. And yet the full quantum mechanical description is this superposition of it being the photon being in the ordinary beam and the ordinary counterclicking, and the photon being in the extraordinary beam and the extraordinary counterclicking. And it's a coherent superposition, which, as we all know, is not an either-or affair. So how do things actually happen? Well, the ontic view, what follows will be a series of caricatures. But if the quantum state is something real, the gap between reality and direct experience cries out for a physical explanation. The conservative explanation is what I would call the conservative explanation is decoherence. It says you can't isolate the photomultipliers from the environment. It's conservative because it doesn't go beyond ordinary quantum mechanics. And as Phil Pearl also reminded me, John Bell would have characterized this as gap trap. That although that may remove practical problems, the conceptual problem of the fact that quantum mechanics stops at the coherent superposition, whereas we all know, or at least I know, I don't know about you, that one thing or the other actually happens. So the objection there is that it's not a solution. There's the radical explanation that Phil will tell us about, which is that a real physical process, not acknowledged in conventional quantum mechanics, rapidly reduces real macroscopic superpositions to one or the other of the two observed components. And this has the great virtue that it can, in principle, be excluded or possibly confirmed by experiment, looking for deviations from the quantum mechanical predictions. So that's a cartoon version of the measurement problem. And the ontic and the epistemic ways of looking at it. Ah, here we go. Yeah, the epistemic view would say the state is simply an ingredient in an algorithm, giving the likelihood of which photomultiplier clicks based on initial information, what kind of the orientation was of the polarizer the photon first went through, and so forth and so on. And implicit in the epistemic view is the fact that things actually happen is an irreducible part of our experience, and quantum states encapsulate connections between features of that experience. And the source of the measurement problem lies, in that view, in reifying the quantum state. If you recognize that it's just a calculational device relating some aspects of our experience to others, it's hard to see what problem remains. Now, what I want to do is suggest what strikes me as a curiously analogous issue in classical physics, in which something unambiguously evident in our direct experience is missing from the physical description of that experience. And in which the source of the paradox is an implicit reification of a mathematical abstraction, implicit in the sense of not being fully aware of it, a bad habit in my technical sense of the term. And this issue is the problem of the now, which I discovered a few months ago when I received the proceedings of a conference that took place here in honor of Abner Shimoni 3 years ago, is known more generally as the problem of transience. And the problem of transience, I think, already shares one thing in common with the measurement problem, namely, if you don't think there's a problem of transience, it's hard to explain to you what the problem of transience is. The same thing is true with the measurement problem. If you take a working, everyday quantum mechanic and try to explain to them what the measurement problem is, you will get nowhere. They just don't see a problem. So I hope some of you get some sense of what the problem of transience is, and that it's like the measurement problem, not only in this respect, but in other respects. The best statement of it I've run across is a statement attributed to Einstein by Carnap, the philosopher. Einstein said that the problem of the now worried him seriously. He explained that the experience of the now, means something special for man, something essentially different from the past and the future, but that this important difference does not and cannot occur within physics. Notice the resonance. The measurement problem is that quantum mechanics does not allow for events to happen. Here is something else that does not occur within physics, that physics cannot account for. That this experience cannot be grasped by science seemed to him a matter of painful but inevitable resignation. Now, Carnap said, Einstein said that. It would be nice to see if you could find something that Einstein actually said without an intermediary. And the closest thing I could find was the condolence letter that he sent to the family of his old friend, Michel Besso. Now he has departed from this strange world a little ahead of me. And indeed, Einstein died within a month or two. That means nothing. People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion. Freeman Dyson, in fact, on the basis of that quote, said Einstein, and seems to agree, Einstein taught us that in physics, the division of space-time in the past, present, and future is an illusion. He also understood that this division is as illusory in human affairs as it is in physics. So, the problem of the now, and I define the now as the present moment, now. right now. It's immediately evident as a special moment of time, or if you want to get more technical, as a brief interval, perhaps a few hundred milliseconds in length. And I would say that if now is an illusion, then everything is an illusion, because everything happens now. I don't know why I'm reporting this to you. I won't tell you who these two interlocutors are, but somebody at Cornell gave a talk on string theory, and he said ultimately string theory will explain everything. And I said string theory will not explain consciousness. Consciousness will remain a mystery. The speaker said consciousness is an illusion. And I said the illusion of consciousness will remain a mystery. And this particular speaker always has the last word, but this conversation took place at a reception and somebody else grabbed him. So that was actually the concluding remark. So here's the problem of the now. Physics has no place for the now. Physics cannot define now and deals only with relations between one time and another. Obvious as the present moment is to me, it cannot be identified in any terms known to today's physics. Now being obvious, I would regard as a corollary to cogito ergo sum. Sum, ergo nunc est. I am, therefore there is a now. Now. Now in the onward sense. It's a dangerous word. There's an uninteresting sense in which there is no now in physics, which a lot of people take to be the sense. Namely, the relativity of simultaneity establishes that there is no global now. And that was certainly a great discovery, that there is no unique way of extending now from me to the rest of the universe. Whether or not events in different places belong to the same now depends on your frame of reference. That's not the sense in which I'm worried about the problem of now. What happens somewhere else has no bearing on what happens here and now, unless it can impinge directly on the being experiencing the now, and events outside the light cone of an event are irrelevant to now, to this now, now. The problem is finding a place in physics for my own local now. And your problem is finding a place in physics for your own local now. And I'll come back in a little while to the question of how my now is related to your now. My now is a special event. And by event, one means something. Some phenomenon whose spatial and temporal extent can be ignored. Right? Which I'll also come back to. And event is something whose breadth and duration you don't have to worry about. Or at least for the purposes of whatever point you're making. And indeed, this is an issue that should be explored if one wanted to make something serious out of these remarks. Why is it a special event? Because it's the real state of affairs. And again, I refuse to define real except by saying what's not real. It's real in the sense that earlier events are not real because they are merely remembered. And later events can only be imagined. It's real in the sense that dreams and hallucinations are not real. Here's another quote from Hermann Weyl, again, giving some sense of what he regards as the problem of the now. He says, the objective world simply is. It does not happen. Only to the gaze of my consciousness, he now turns into poetry, only to the gaze of my consciousness, crawling upward along the lifeline of my body, does a section of the world come to life as a fleeting image in space, which continuously changes in time. So, here's the problem of the now as stated by Weyl, namely, this is my what he calls my lifeline, I guess you would call it my world line, the history of events in my life, and here are a series of events, and they're all just undifferentiated points in space-time. Whereas the experience we have is that one of these events is now. So it's as if one of the events has a special status, and that status keeps changing. I'm very proud of this. I'll run it backwards so you can see it again. Maybe the high point of the talk. So, what's missing from the physical description is that green line that moves along the lifetime of the body. Let's see, I've gone the wrong direction. Where am I? Whoops. Shouldn't have switched my thumb. Yeah. I mean, somehow, for me, my now is a special event. It's a limit point of the remembered past. The status of any particular event as my now is fleeting, as you saw from that figure. It fades into a past event as subsequent nows emerge. And although that's a humdrum part of how we experience the world, it doesn't seem to correspond to anything in physics at all, and there seems to be no way of talking about it in physics. For example, this is one of the issues that was raised in a rather nice paper by Stephen Savitt at the Shimoni meeting here. If my now moves along my space-time trajectory, how fast does it move? Since motion is in space-time, an answer seems to require a second time outside ordinary time, and physics knows nothing about that. So, what I want to suggest is that there's a mistake which we make that gives rise to the problem of the now and makes us think that something as obvious as that isn't a part of our physics. And I would say that the mistake is to reify space-time. By conferring objective reality on space-time, I am seduced into regarding the space-time continuum as the arena in which my life is lived. And in that arena, all the events from my birth to the death, all of the events in my life, because I allow myself to die, are all laid out, and there's nothing there that represents now. So, we have to say, what is space-time? And to deal with the problem of now, I think what you have to say in a forthright way is that space-time is a four-dimensional diagram. It's a mathematical construction. I use it to represent the events of my past experience. And it also enables me to represent my conjectures, deductions, or expectations for events that are not in my past. But one should not confuse the continuum that we have invented to represent events with the events themselves. Here's yet another Einstein quote. Einstein is wonderful on this subject. Space and time are modes by which we think, not conditions under which we live. This is a, what? Yeah, yeah, indeed. You know where Einstein said it? There are a certain number of apocryphal Einstein quotes floating out there on the web. The other one is, it'll come to me what the other one is. I have been unable to find that in anything Einstein wrote. And if anybody knows where he actually said it, I would love to know. Because in this argument, for me, Einstein is always coming down on the side of my own particular kind of flaky anti-realism, which is extremely strange, since Einstein, of course, was the champion of realism in all these arguments. And yet, this particular one, I think, is quite interesting. There's more. And this one I do know the source. So this is straight from the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. He says, if I say this train arrives here at 7 o'clock, I mean something like this: the pointing of the small hand of my watch to 7 and the arrival of the train are simultaneous events. Now, time in that quote, according to Einstein, is a grossly macroscopic. The time of an event is macroscopic. It's the reading of a watch. And the connection is rough. It's approximate. We shall not discuss here, he says, more or less on the same page, the inexactitude which lurks in the concept of simultaneity of two events at approximately the same place, which can only be removed by an abstraction. That abstraction is space-time, collection of events treated as a continuum of points. So, what happens if I take my now to be the objective reality, and space-time is an abstract representation of my experience? Then it seems to me the problem of the now goes away. At any moment, I can plot all my past experience as a continuous time-like curve in my graph that terminates in the now. As each now recedes into memory, it ceases to be the real state of affairs and is replaced by subsequent nows. If I continually update my diagram, my trajectory in the diagram grows, always terminating in the current now. So now we go back and say, aha, Hermann Weyl didn't draw the right picture. The picture you should draw looks like this. Here's now. Here's a later now. And what was now is no longer now. And I'm updating the drive. I keep redrawing. Here it is again. Here's the next now. Oh dear. Ah, there's another now. And there we are. a rather different picture. What's advancing are the moments at which I draw the diagram. So the source of the paradox was confusing time in my diagrammatic representation of events with real time, which is the reading of my watch. The motion of the now along my trajectory in my diagram simply reflects the fact that I experience more events to record in my diagram as time on my watch advances. And in fact, you can even answer the question of how fast my now moves in space-time. My trajectory in my series of diagrams grows 1 second of proper time. Proper time is now related to length in the diagram and angle in the diagram. Its length in the diagram increases by a distance representing a second of time, as indicated by the ticks of a moving clock, per second of my experience. And this fact is simply a representation of the diagram of the obvious fact that if you ask me the question, what time is it now, I look at my watch and report the time that I see in my watch. So, I would say that there is no problem of the now for the now of a single sentient being. And the solution recognizes that the diagram is a bookkeeping device useful for representing events and not an objective arena in which events happen. Now, what about reconciling my now with your now? Well, there's another irreducible fact, it seems to me, and I assume it seems to you, which is that if several sentient beings are together in a single event, if that event happens to be now for one of them, it's now for all of them. Whenever we get together, our nows coincide. Otherwise, there couldn't be any communication. We couldn't talk to each other. If my now was your half hour ago, we'd be in serious trouble. So the commonality of nows when sentient beings are together means that the definition of now can be extended from sentient beings to events, at least in a conditional sense. That is, an event happens now if and only if it is now for any and hence every sentient being present at that event. Yeah, digression. The fact that our nows agree when we are together can only happen if both of our nows advance along the trajectory each of us is plotting at 1 second of experience per proper second of clock time along our trajectory. Otherwise, if our nows coincided the first time we were together, they would not coincide when we came back together the next time. So that the twin paradox, far from being paradoxical, makes it possible for the nows of the traveling and stay-at-home twin to coincide both at separation and reunion. So that's a physics way of talking about two different nows. Does extending now to events make trouble? I would say it does not, because a sentient being can take a global now to be any space-like surface containing the local now. The fact that space-like separated observers can disagree about their global nows has no consequences. So since the experience of now is strictly a local one. So, summary. The problem of the now arises from an incorrect identification of a powerful abstraction with the reality of our experience. That there is such a thing as the present moment, namely now, is an undeniable part of that experience. That a useful way of representing our experience appears not to contain a now does not mean that now does not exist. It means that we must not identify that formalism with the world the formalism was constructed to represent. Oh, here's a table with which I will conclude, in which I try to relate, to point out the parallels between the measurement problem and the problem of transience. The nature of the problem. In the measurement problem, the problem is that experiments have outcomes. In the problem of the now, the problem is that time passes. In both cases, the evidence for the problem is our direct experience. Why is it a problem? It's a problem because quantum states superpose outcomes, and therefore nothing happens. In the case of transience, it's because there is no motion in space-time. Everything is laid out there. There is no transient, no passing now. That little green dot, that physics has nothing to say about that little green dot moving. And the source of the problem and the measurement problem is the reification of the quantum state, and the problem of transience, it's the reification of space-time. And with that, since I was told the talk was supposed to be 45 minutes with 15 minutes for questions, I will stop. Thank you.
Be just a reification of one of your extractions. Then I realized I was worrying about nothing because that had it the wrong way around. And if anything, you would be a reification of my abstraction.
Indeed.
A lot less worrying.
Yeah.
And then later in the talk, when you started talking about other people, it seemed clear that you didn't want to extend this line of reasoning from the case of now to the case of I. So you didn't want to treat the problem of other minds as being like the problem of other times. I just wondering what you see the disanalogy as being. I mean, why doesn't these kind of considerations which support kind of realism about the now and nothing else also support realism about the me and nothing else?
I mean, for me, you are a hypothesis, but you're such an utterly compelling hypothesis that
it's nice of you to say so. And
oh, you always have been.
I'd like to reciprocate. But I'd also like to say that I find the existence of other times a very compelling hypothesis too. So
really,
I want to put that in the same camp. I want to be realist, not only about you and everyone else here and 6 billion other people.
I see.
More than that, share this planet with us, but I also want to be realist about past and the future. And obviously, you want to draw a distinction between these two cases.
Indeed.
I'm wondering what the basis for the distinction is.
The past is what I remember, and the future is what I anticipate.
Okay, so my view is I have much better access to the past than I do to the contents of your mind.
You have better access to your past. Yeah. But you have access to the contents of, I mean, you're having access to the contents of my mind right now.
Well, yes, but
and
it's
I do yours.
Whereas in the case of the past, you know, I could just get online and watch what was happening at some past meeting here at PI. And so, by ordinary scientific standards, I can just observe the past directly. But I can't do that with the contents of your mind.
You're observing a movie, of course, which is a very detailed more detailed, more precise than memory tends to be.
Yeah, it's a little bit indirect, but it's less indirect than my knowledge of the contents of your mind, Sean.
I would have. I would give a certain primacy to the possibility of communicating with another sentient being. That has an immediacy to it.
Okay.
You know, I mean, this is very naive.
I don't want to hog the discussion. I mean, I think it's very interesting to compare. I think the sort of central point, the issue of the analogy between this and the measurement problem is a very interesting one, and my question is a little bit of a side issue.
But it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. If Rob will indulge me, one small thing before I finish. You claimed at one point that effectively the conversations were simultaneous, but it seems to me that's not actually so. I mean, in the age of voicemail, we have these kind of extended conversations where the different participants are actually at different times. So you got a voicemail left sometime yesterday, and the person who's left the voicemail uses the
right
now.
Right, it's a message from the past. I'm responding to the voicemail.
Okay, that's a
yes.
Hand over to someone else.
Yes, well, I would say the person who delivered the message delivered it at their now, at the time of delivery. Yes.
I'd just like to say I think you've given an oversimplified account of what the measurement problem is for many people working in this field.
Indeed.
Put it as, well, the quantum state evolves into a superposition, and if you regard the quantum state in ontic terms, then you seem to get a problem. But it seems to me that is just a particular example, if you will, of the measurement problem in certain kinds of theories. If you have a theory where the quantum state is epistemic, and there are such ideas, a lot of people in this field would say, well, there is still a measurement problem, which is essentially the problem of why is it that in the macroscopic domain we have a notion of a real state of affairs? Philosophically tricky as that might be, but nevertheless there is this notion, you're standing there, Hugh Price is there mm-hmm. are a certain number of chairs in the room. There is a notion of a real state of affairs at the macroscopic level. We don't have such a notion at the microscopic level for quantum systems. You know, there's an electron in a box. What is actually in the box? Is there a particle sitting somewhere? Is it moving? We don't have such a notion. Now, the problem, the measurement problem, is really, well, where is the boundary between these two domains? And this is the way I see Bell as having portrayed the measurement
problem. Yeah, the shifty split.
The shifty split. I mean, the way you've put it in terms of the quantum state, it's a sort of popular, I'd say it's a sort of popularized version of the measurement problem, but it doesn't do justice to it. And the problem with it is that it gives the impression that, well, look, if the quantum state is epistemic, then there's no problem. But really, there is still a problem. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, I mean, clearly what I said was a cartoon version of the measurement problem. But I think to make the position stronger, you would have to say that just as there's something fundamental about the now, there is something fundamental and basic about experience, and that quantum mechanics, in a certain sense, has to be viewed as subsidiary to experience, as a way of tying together aspects of experience. But experience would certainly have to play a special role, just as the now plays a special role. I would agree. And it's not at all clear to me how hard it will be to make that coherent. Thank you. Yeah.
If you had a quantum theory where you could identify the states as corresponding to reality, might it not resolve this problem as well, in that we are devices, and we could be presumably modeled, maybe simpler models, but maybe we could get more sophisticated. And then our description would also include the description of our perception of the now. So if one takes that point of view, one could think that perhaps there is a relationship. One could make a quantum mechanics for which one could identify real states. So I'm going to go a little further in that. Suppose nature was kind enough to give us a preferred basis. For example, suppose that we had a theory of gravity, and that you could take some complicated function, perhaps, of the gravitational variables and find a basis, an eigenbasis of that, and then do a Schmidt decomposition of that and the rest of the world, so that the state vector then would be written as a superposition of direct products of the preferred basis and the rest of the world. And suppose, I'm supposing a lot, of course. Suppose the
You're
rest
supposing
of the world.
Supposing what?
I'm supposing a lot here. But suppose nature had been kind enough to give us that, and we were smart enough to find it. And suppose the states in that direct product of the rest of the world were sensible states. That is, you didn't have macroscopic things in a superposition of different places. If you put in measurement devices such as people, they didn't have a superposition of thoughts, they had an actual thought, then the two problems would be solved together. In fact, if you had such a preferred basis, the subject matter of this whole conference perhaps might be quite different. It would be interesting to think about the various points of view that people take with regard to the state vector, and which ones would be trivial and which ones would be interesting. The many worlds picture, for example, would be trivial. I mean, one would have such a superposition. You could call each one of those states a world, but why bother? I'm assuming that there's a super selection rule so that they don't re-interfere. So you'd never know about them. It would be like talking about angels on the head of a pin. If you were a person who wanted to do ordinary quantum mechanics by the histories method, well, you'd have your histories right there. I mean, you could make a history, a decoherence functional, but why bother? I mean, they're right there. If you wanted to talk about the state vector as describing knowledge rather than reality, you're welcome to do it. I mean, there is knowledge. Everything you know, presumably, would be in one of those states. Why assign knowledge to it? That seems to me those three would be trivial. But what would be interesting, I think, would be the de Broglie-Bohm point of view and the collapse point of view. Because if you had a de Broglie-Bohm kind of theory, so you would have a point in configuration space, it would be quite interesting to see if the conclusions that you drew from understanding what that point in configuration space described would be the same as what one would derive from the state vector. In the case of a collapse theory, it would be interesting to see if you could that superposition, one could have a description which would in fact be just describe one term in that superposition. Now, if one could do both of those, then it would be interesting in the sense that when one had different ontologies, different points of view that one could have with regard to the same thing, different ways of looking at it, and as Einstein said, the more ways you can, Feynman said rather, the more ways you can look at things at a single thing, perhaps the deeper that thing is, and one could just appreciate it. But if there was a conflict between what one could conclude from the de Broglie-Bohm point and predictions and the quantum mechanics predictions, or if one could only do that single term if the state was slightly different from the state that the superposition provided, then there would be a possibility of experimental differentiation, and there would be something to have a conference about, namely, how could we test these theories? Maybe one of those points of view is better than the other.
As I said to you in the letters column in September, my instincts tell me that you're barking up the wrong tree, but if you find a squirrel, I will be among the first to sing your praises. You reminded me that we were both at that Shimoni conference 3 years ago, and I was amazed at the things that are in the proceedings of that conference that I have no memory of at all. And I hadn't remembered, for instance, that the entire evening session that Lee Smullen presided over was largely devoted to the problem of the now. And do you remember that? I must have had too much beer. Yeah, true. You do. But I was surprised to read that there are people who do think that a future physics may have green lights in it, have a physical now. And I learned from Abner that Polish physicist, whose name I forgot, in fact, made a suggestion similar to what you've said, that a dynamic physical collapse mechanism may provide a physical correlate of now, and that Abner was intrigued by that suggestion.
David, perhaps your next talk could be about how your instincts are formed.
That would surely be of no interest to anyone but me, possibly my wife.
Okay, David, you say on the board that the source of the measurement problem is the reification of the quantum state. I think it's important to stress that the measurement problem is not necessarily due to the reification of the quantum state, because there exist interpretations with a realist ontology which don't have a measurement problem. I'm thinking of the de Broglie-Bohm stuff.
Uh-huh.
And the problem with the now, I mean, that presumably emerges from the interpretation of relativity, which assigns reality to 4D space-time. So there's no distinction between past, present, future. Three-dimensional objects don't exist, four-dimensional ones do. And there's no absolute simultaneity. If you just say space is what stops things from being in the same place, time is what stops things happening simultaneously, and you adopt a Lorentzian viewpoint, then you can say that there's absolute simultaneity and time is just a result of the fact that stuff happens. So then the now becomes well-defined.
One of the things I said was that I don't think the problem of the now is part of the problem of simultaneity. That it's the now of along a given world line that is problematic. Yeah. Right, but I mean you would still be faced with the problem of which simultaneity sheet even if it was absolute, was the current one. Yeah, but which is the one? Well, I would say that there's still no green simultaneity sheet, just as there's no green dot.
This one? The real reason why you don't remember those conversations is that they didn't take place.
Oh?
The sound quality was so bad that we just decided to make stuff up.
Really?
No. But actually, there's a serious point about that.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really, at some point during your talk, you said, well, the past is the stuff that I remember. But we don't really think that. Because, you know, I thought my past light cone was just the stuff that I, the past light cone of this now was just the stuff that I remember, it would be awfully spotty, right? There wouldn't be very much in it, actually. But we do think that events took place at all those times that I don't remember. And we also think that events take place that aren't the now of any sentient being. And so there's a lot more, there's a lot more going on than just fitting nows of sentient beings together. And when you do cosmology, it's almost irresistible to extrapolate events that are beyond our past light cone, and perhaps not in the past light cone of any sentient observer. Maybe not. We don't know, but it's not a requirement. So I guess wondering how all this fits into your picture of reification of space-time being a bad habit. And I guess the main motivation is that, if I can be convinced that it's a bad habit, then I'll try to break it. But I'm not yet convinced, because it seems like I would have to give up an awful lot if I did try to break it.
I agree with you that cosmologists are the greatest offenders.
And is it really an offense?
I've always found it offensive, but that's little more than a personal prejudice. I mean, clearly I can't stop you from doing it, but it makes me very nervous.
I have two comments, one a positive one on real, and one a negative one, which is filling in the technical philosophical background to Hugh Price's more diplomatically phrased challenge, but it's the same idea, basically. So the positive one is, I think you actually did give a perfectly good, adequate definition of real, indeed exactly the same one, pretty much, that the best philosopher who's talked about this ever did. And I'm thinking of J.L. Austin's discussion in Sense and Sensibilia, where he says that real is a substantive, hungry word that doesn't wear the trousers, by which he meant that the most important, I mean, if it's not obvious, by which he meant that the most important use, indeed, the only way in which the term real gets a grip is by ruling stuff out. So it's really, it's because you're saying if you say something is real, then you're ruling out the case under which it's not real. What is it for it to be not real? Well, that depends on the kind of thing it is. So if it's a decoy duck, then it's not a real duck. In a different way than a made-up story is not a real story about how the world is. We need to fill in what I'm saying isn't real, and then I get a grip on what the content of that denial is, and then also, contrary-wise, what the positive story is. So I think you're spot on with real, so you need to be defensive about that. The negative comment is, I think you've misdiagnosed, I'd be tempted to suggest you've misdiagnosed the nature of the problem of transience, why it isn't. I agree with you that it's a non-problem. But for a different reason. I don't think it's at all to do with reification of space-time. Rather, it stems from, again, to use philosopher's jargon, from not recognizing the indexical or token reflexive character of tensed talk. And this is the point of Hugh Price's question, because we have a number of bits of language which function in a token reflexive or an indexical way. So pronouns, typically, I, me, you, he, she, it. Demonstratives, this, there, that. Mm-hmm. But also items of tense, now is one of them, and also just the tense features in verbs. What makes an item of language be one of those items of language? Well, it's if this truth values or sentences made using it can depend on the circumstances in which the utterance is made. And so if I say, I'm hungry, that's different from you saying you're hungry. If I say I'm hungry now, that's a different claim from saying that Wayne's hungry in an hour's time. So what's going on is that you have pieces of language which have determinate meaning, function from context to proposition, but where the context that they're uttered in makes a contribution to the content of what's said. And that's precisely what happens in the now case. And the eternalist, someone who believes in the four-dimensional block universe, all events in it ontologically on a par, is just going to say, you can give perfectly adequate truth conditions for the statements made using tense language. So all our talk of now and all the rest of it can come out true in virtue of tenseless facts. That's pretty quite a standard view, actually, in the philosophy of time, particularly amongst those who are eternalists, i.e. most philosophers of physics. And so that bunch of people, and it's a large bunch of people, is going to say, we don't buy this analogy because we don't buy that this is the right analysis of the transience of the now and why that's not a problem.
So the tenseless facts would involve correlations between the utterances and the circumstances attending the utterances.
So between the concrete utterance, the wibbling of the sound waves that constituted the token of my utterance of a particular tense sentence.
Yeah. Somehow I'm captured by my utterances, though. Somehow that misses the nowness.
In the case of the measurement problem of quantum theory, that's forced on us by interference experiments. So it's forced on us by interference experiments, the measurement problem in quantum theory. And so it's those interference experiments, the particular detailed data we collect that lead us to adopt wave functions in doing calculations. And then trying to interpret what the wave function means leads us to the measurement problem. Is there some analogous experimental detail that leads us leads to the problem of transience?
You're saying the statement that events happen is an experimental, I wouldn't have said that that's an experimental outcome. I would have said there are experiments, and the theory describes a superposition of outcomes, and our experience is that there is one outcome. And the analogy with the now is that our experience, my experience, says this is now. There it goes. Bye-bye. But I'm saying experience is necessary for the understanding of the outcomes of experiments. I mean, I'm certainly taking experience in both cases as the basic substratum on which everything else is built, which may be very naive.
But maybe, I mean, so really the measurement problem is more of a particular problem to quantum theory. There are theories that don't have a measurement problem, and that's because they don't have the same detailed data leading to interference patterns. Whereas the transience problem seems to be a much more general problem that any theory with time in it has. It doesn't depend on some detailed curves that you collect in experiments of a certain type. That's my point. I mean,
that
doesn't have to be an analogy. I just wondered if there was a disanalogy between the two problems in this case.
It's a problem with what is often taken to be the physicist's view of time, reconciling that with the subjective experience of time. Yeah, and in that sense, it's broader.
Okay, well, we can continue the discussion over coffee, which is upstairs in the bistro, and let's meet back here at 11. And thank David again.